Good evening, everyone. I'm Jenny Sinclair. I'm founder and director of Together for the Common Good. Welcome to this, our first public talk of 2024. In these talks, we're asking how can common good thinking help us play our part in spiritual and civic renewal? We're featuring speakers from different traditions who draw on the tradition of Catholic social thought to explore how this Christian theology can be a blessing on public life, how it can resource us as we reflect on how God is calling us out of this deep cultural, social, and political malaise at this point in our history, whether it's about what it means to be human, the economy, work, nature, freedom, civic participation, or social peace. All of these areas need our attention in this time of profound change. So before we get started, I'd just like to thank Word on Fire UK for their partnership in putting on this event and to CCLA for hosting this evening. CCLA is our long-term partner and a great friend to Together for the Common Good, coming up for nearly 10 years. CCLA is the UK's leading sustainability fund manager for charities, faith and public sector organisations with a long history of managing assets for Christian organisations. And they have an investment fund aligned with Catholic social teaching, and they run the Better World Fund for individual investors, and they provide the secretariat for the Church Investors Group, helping Christian investors generate faith-aligned investment policies. So we're very grateful for them hosting this tonight. So for those of you who are watching online, we'll be taking questions later. So if you're watching on Zoom, please use the Q&A function. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, please do enter questions in the chat. So I'm delighted that tonight we're going to hear from Matthew Petrusek, who is uniquely equipped to help us explore the question of human identity and the common good response to the secular ideologies that are challenging our culture. He will be giving the lecture before a small invited audience here tonight in London, and I'm delighted to see so many of you joining us online. I'm really happy to have you here, Matt, and I'm grateful to you for helping us set the tone for an honest and open conversation. So Matt is the Senior Director and Professor of Catholic Ethics at the Word on Fire Institute in the USA, Bishop Robert Barron's Evangelization Ministry. Matthew lectures on philosophical and theological ethics, Christian theology, politics, social issues, and the Catholic intellectual tradition. His work is dedicated to show the relevance and prophetic nature of Catholic thought to a wide audience in as much clarity as possible in the context of a society that has lost its way. And our societies have lost their way. The subject of identity is at the heart of this crisis, and it's causing so much confusion and division, including among Christians. There is a sense that dissent carries too much risk, and so people are self-censoring, which itself is a risk to the common good, which is built on relationship. And so I felt this was about time that we talked about this among the churches. Christians are trying to make sense of what it means to be God's people in this time of cultural unravelling. And at all times, not least now, we're called to resist tribalism. But just as in the wider society, there is cultural division within the churches. Some celebrate the trends as progressive social justice ideologies gain increasing traction, while others are appalled by the impact of postmodern interpretations but are frightened of raising questions. Some believe that free market ideology is a solution to the battle of ideas, while others believe that faith is a private matter and the church should steer clear of the political arena altogether. I see this as a plague of confusion over the churches, and I think we're meant to be members of one body, but that body is weakened by division at the very moment when our hyper-politicised society is in trouble and needs our help. And I think there's no such thing as a private faith. Our Lord Jesus Christ, indeed the whole prophetic tradition in Scripture, calls us to work for justice in the world. The question is how to interpret justice in our time. And so I've invited Matt to speak for us this evening, to draw on his expertise in the Catholic social thought traditions and set out the common good response to identity politics. I know his talk will be challenging, surprising, and informative, and my hope is this will help us make sense of what's going on and stimulate further conversation. Without further ado, Matt, the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jenny, for that very generous introduction. If my talk is surprising, I hope it turns out to be a happy surprise for you all, but we shall see. And thank you all for joining us at home or wherever you're watching from. So I'd like to make three primary arguments tonight that lead to three conclusions that I hope are persuasive or at least plausible. The first conclusion is that identity politics is hopelessly at odds with the basic tenets of human dignity and natural law justice. The second conclusion is that the common good tradition provides a unique, and I would say the only, solution to the problem of identity politics. And it does so while including whatever may be good about identity politics, or putatively good about identity politics. So it includes what's good and discards what's not. Third conclusion is that the common good tradition solving the problem of identity politics is highly relevant to the task of evangelization in the sense that it can engender what we could call a dispositional conversion or an attitudinal conversion. So it's not necessarily opening the door to a full acceptance of Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior, but it's at least opening the possibility, certainly sort of the condition for the possibility of taking that seriously by opening up the reality between morality and God. So let me start with some definitions. Ideology. So what is an ideology? And is the common good just one ideology among others? No, it's not. Oftentimes, the perception is that when we look at different political alternatives, different political theories, we sort of line them up on a table, and each one of them is making different claims about the nature of the good and the nature of how that good is achieved. But basically, they're all understood as ideological options. And so what we'd be doing with the common good ideology is just adding one more alternative to sort of the panoply of alternative that's already there. However, I want to argue that the common good is categorically, it's qualitatively different than its worldview competitors. The reason is because an ideology, at least as I'm defending it in this presentation, is a comprehensive worldview that seeks to describe the totality of reality and prescribe a systematic moral and political response to reality, so prescribed in one of two ways. So option A is that it does so by severing morality and therefore politics from any reference to the transcendent, and those would be secular ideologies, of which there are many, but that would be the general category. So secular ideologies sever morality and politics from any reference to the transcendent, or they conflate the transcendent with morality and politics. And we could call those religious or theological ideologies. This, as focusing on identity politics, we'll primarily be looking at the category of secular ideology this evening, but it's important to note that there are religious ideologies as well. So in sum, an ideology is a totality without transcendence, Identity politics is an ideology. However, it's not the only one. Utilitarianism, classical liberalism, libertarianism, and some forms of political conservatism are just as ideological as well. Theocracies would also qualify as an ideology. The common good, however, is not an ideology. It neither severs morality and politics from the transcendent, nor does it conflate morality and politics with the transcendent. And so in this case, it's in a unique category. So if that gives us a basic sense of what an ideology is, what then is identity politics? Identity politics is oftentimes used synonymously with political progressivism, or what's now being referred to as wokeism. There may be some nuanced distinctions between political progressivism and wokeism and identity politics. However, for this presentation, we could use all three synonymously. The intellectual genealogy of identity politics or progressivism or wokeism it's immensely complex. It includes influences from postmodernism, basically the idea that truth, this starts off, of course, as a literary movement, but has escaped the walls of academia and run mad through our society. The basic idea that truth is socially constructed and that there is no such thing as objective truth. So it has roots in postmodernism. It has roots in post colonialism, especially the thought of thinkers like Frantz Fanon, and the idea that the world can be divided into two categories of oppressor and oppressed. And within those two categories, it's only the oppressed who have access to the true nature of what's really going on. And the oppressors, sort of by definition, are epistemically limited in their ability to understand what's truly good. We'll see how important epistemology, or how we understand what we know to be true, is to identity politics and to the debate surrounding identity politics. It also includes strands of Marxism. It includes strands of critical race theory. It also, surprisingly perhaps, includes strands of classical liberalism and even libertarianism. And so this is why it's so important to recognize, to get down into the basement of thought, because what may look like ideological enemies on the surface, so libertarianism and identity politics, are in a sense rightly seen as completely at odds with each other, and we see that playing out in contemporary debates. However, they actually share a kind of basic premise that truth, or truth beyond what the individual thinks is true, is completely outside the bounds of a common rationality. So in that sense, they're deeply united, even if they end up being enemies on the surface. And it also includes utilitarianism as well. The greatest good for the greatest number, which is not the common good, right? Common good is the true, authentic good for all, not the greatest good for the greatest number. So because of this complex genealogy, I think the most effective way to define identity politics is to look at some of its dominant features. And I'll be focusing on six features. The first is identity politics ideology tends to, I would actually say exclusively, has what's called an experientially based epistemology. Experientially based epistemology. What do I mean by that? Well, epistemology comes from episteme, logos, right? So it's the logos of episteme. Episteme is understood as a systematic understanding of how we know what we know. So an epistemology gives us the basic framework for being able to identify the methodology that leads to any potential conclusions of how we identify anything as true, as false, and then put into the moral realm as truly good or truly bad. So by saying that identity politics is based on an experientially based epistemology, what I'm saying is that identity politics and identity politics ideology derives its beliefs from the self-reported lived experiences. Perhaps you've heard that term, lived experiences of the individuals that it deems to be representative of a politically favored group. Now that's important. That's an important caveat here. It's not the lived experiences of all individuals of a particular category, but rather those deemed to be representative of that category and who can speak on behalf of the other members of the group. So knowledge is generated by sort of a upper caste of individuals within a group who appeal to their own experiences in order to say what is true and false and good and bad. Identity politics ideology also and consequently sees rational objectivity and epistemic universality, meaning it's at least theoretically possible for all of us to come to the same conclusion as rational beings. They see those as social constructs specifically generated to oppress marginalized groups. So even the claim that human beings are universally rational, and because of that we have the capacity to come to a shared consensus based on a rational agreement, that claim in and of itself is rejected as true, and also tagged with a bad motivation, saying the only reason you'd ever say that we share rationality is because you're participating in some oppressive structure of knowledge and ultimately the politics. Crucially, dissenting members of an identity group, for example, those who disagree with the lived experience epistemology, so a member of an identity group who says, I actually don't think lived experience is sufficient in order to come to a conclusion, moral or otherwise, are often deemed to be traitors or dupes who have adopted the oppressor's point of view. This has been an issue within my own family. So my wife, we live in the United States, my wife and I have been married for 20 years. She's from Argentina, and she moved to the United States after we got married in our early 20s. We had to learn English, had to start from scratch living in the United States context. Fortunately, I spoke Spanish, so it was not just the language of love. We could actually have a real relationship. And one of the things she quickly discovered when she entered into the university system, because she had to start from scratch, is that she was now a Latina. And as a Latina, represented not only being from a particular geographic region of the world and also speaking Spanish, but also necessarily inhabiting a particular worldview as well, specifically an identity politics worldview. And so in her classes, time and time again, she would raise her voice against what the professor assumed was a consensus within the class about some political issue. And she would say, well, I don't see it that way. And time again, she would be told, that's only because you have a white husband. So think about what that necessarily implies, right? To say you are a representative of a group means you must think a particular kind of way. And if you don't think that way, it's only because you're either naive or stupid. In a sane world, that would be called bigoted and racist. But in the world of identity politics, it's considered to be enlightened. But it is a feature. So conformity of thought is necessitated within this particular ideology. It's also crucial to know up front that sense experience cannot be falsified, meaning someone claiming that they see things a particular kind of way or feel things in a particular kind of way, saying they, for example, feel unsafe. There's no way to test that, either empirically or rationally, metaphysically. It's an expression of a subjective experience. And so if you base your whole ideology on lived experience, and lived experience, by definition, cannot be falsified, what you've just done is generated a system of thought that, by definition, cannot be challenged from the outside. It makes itself immune by design to critique. And then, as we'll see in just a moment, identifies any critiques as being, quote-unquote, dangerous. So the first feature is experientially based epistemologies. The second feature, and this is related, is group control of language and logic. Group control of language and logic. The creation of in-group language created for out-group consumption. So as a consequence of rejecting rational objectivity and by extension a commitment to universally intelligible language, identity politics ideology seeks to advance its goals by imbuing words and statements with whatever meaning an identity group ascertains will best advance its political interests. Now, what this results in, precisely because it grants itself the power not only over language but of logic as well, is the expression of overtly contradictory statements. For example, colorblindness is racist. All lives matter is bigotry. Property destruction, or even physical violence, is peaceful resistance. Words are violence. Allowing people to vote is anti-democratic, or using the word her to refer to male genitalia. A paradigmatic example of this form of thought or anti-thought in action we see in the theorist Ibram X. Kendi, who's done a lot of work, or at least a lot of proclamations in behalf of the anti-racism, what he's identified as anti-racism. This is a quote from his work, his early work at least. Quote, the only remedy to racist discrimination is anti-racist discrimination, unquote. The substance of this claim is that racial discrimination is both unjust and just at the same time. It violates the basic laws of logic. So, feature number two is group control of language and logic. Feature number three is a tendency to generate imperious neologisms. So new words, the ideology invents new words, but also imbues them with imperious power, the power to command, the power to compel, the power to force compliance. So related to the previous feature, identity politics generates words and slogans whose meaning is A, entirely dependent on the identity group. So the identity group grants itself the power to give the word a whatever content it wants to assign to it. And yet, at the same time, B, claims that the moral authority of the word that they have now, I have to be careful with the word they, that those who adhere to this ideology have now, so you can think of, they take a word, they sort of cut it from the bottom, they gut it, and they stuff it with new meaning, with the meaning that the identity group's will has generated. That also necessarily has authority of those in the quote-unquote out group as well. So the examples of this kind of neologisms, these imperious neologisms, include, so this is sort of a greatest hits rendition, hate, love is love, non-binary, mansplaining, misgendering, dead naming, cultural appropriation, believe all women, white male privilege, patriarchy, feminism, heteronormativity, cis normativity, silence is violence, microaggression, Latinx or Latinx, equity, birthing person, allyship, queer baiting, pansexual, toxic masculinity, reproductive health care, and gender affirming care, among many others. Anyone who sincerely questions the meaning, the coherence, or the selective applicability of the terms, so maybe used in this instance, but it's not used in this instance, those who ask those kinds of questions are deemed as being motivated by hate or suffering from a phobia. And I want to pause here on the instance of tagging dissent as a phobia. So phobia is literally what? It's a form of mental illness, right? To have a phobia means that you have some kind of paralyzing fear to something that is not objectively fearful, right? So if you have a phobia of cats or a phobia of spiders, the basic idea is that it has a claim on you that prevents you from thinking clearly precisely because the fear has overcome your rational capacities. So when individuals who disagree with an ideology are described as being homophobic or transphobic or what other phobia we can be applied, the idea is that they're saying you're mentally ill. And so what do we do with people who are mentally ill? Do we argue with them? Do we have a debate with them? At best, we medicate them. At worst, we lock them up and get them out of society because they're a danger to themselves as others. So it's not just some mere rhetorical device of using a phobia. There's a deep tyrannical impulse underneath it. Feature number 4. It conflates, so identity politics ideology conflates opposing viewpoints with harm or danger. So because identity politics ideology rejects rational standards of truth, including empirical truth, or falsity, or coherence as valid forms of engagement, the only tool they can use to resist and attack contrary viewpoints is to call them unsafe or harmful. Now, it's crucial to note here that given the other premises of this ideology, safety and harm, like every other word, has no fixed objective meaning. It's entirely dependent on the identity group's wills and aims. So, because identity politics ideology reframes dissent as a form of violence, it therefore consequently authorizes identity groups to be protected from speech because they identify it as violent, which generates a moral imperative for what? For all those to be silent who are dissenting, right? Because dissent is now defined as violence, the state, the authorities have an obligation to protect the use of violence among the population. So that by kind of a magical syllogism here, the state now has the moral authority and imperative to silence particular forms of speech. And potentially, violence can be used to quell violence, right? Justifiably, potentially. So violence can be used to quell speech as well. So you see, these are not just sort of harmless ideas that may be sort of laughably absurd when we examine them. They lead to real restructuring of society and all in one direction, and that's towards totalitarianism. Feature number 5, it's focused exclusively on attaining and maintaining power. Identity Baltics ideology tends to have a mercantilist view of power. There is a fixed supply of power in the world, in the community, and if one group has it, that necessarily means it has been taken by another group. Thus, politics is not about pursuing justice per se, or some objective conception of a shared good, but rather about advancing one group's interests at the expense of other groups. You may pause and say, well, what about the conception of intersectionality? Perhaps you've had that term, heard that term before, intersectionality. Isn't that a way in which identity politics is seeking to find unity among different groups for some kind of pursuit of the common good? Now, to answer that question, we have to remember all the other premises of identity politics, specifically the premises having to do with the generation of knowledge and where truth claims come from. That is, they're all subjective. They all depend on the will of the identity group. So, in a sense, we can already see that substantive agreement, rational consensus, is not a possibility. So that's already been taken off the table. So what then could possibly unite identity groups? Given that we can't come to any kind of shared conclusion, all we can have is what? A shared enemy. And so the premises leading up to this feature of identity politics, that it's focused on power, is that we need some kind of binding agent among identity groups who disagree with themselves internally, necessarily so, right? Because each group has the authority to define reality however it chooses to define reality, so there necessarily will be conflict. The only hope of these groups not warring with each other is to have some common enemy. We see this paradigmatically in the expression of diversity, equity, and inclusion that identifies, typically, it's white, heterosexual, English-speaking men as the common enemy that unites all the other intersectional groups. So intersectionality may sound like some conception of looking for a common good, and allyship is another word, but it's all premised on having a common enemy. And of course, if that common enemy were to fall, what would happen? You'd need the generation of a new common enemy in order to make this system work. Within this same category, any empirical inequality among groups is ipso facto evidence of oppression. And questioning the causal relationship between inequality and oppression generates the charge that you are on the side of the oppressor. So, for example, if we look at a sociological analysis within of a particular segment of society, and we say, well, this group has this amount of resources, and this group has this amount of resources, there's an inequality here. Identity politics ideology says the only possible explanation for that is oppression. Even suggesting or asking the question whether there might be other variables is itself used as evidence to say that the system is oppressive. So the conclusion is already set. It's just a matter of imposing it. Remember, empirical analysis has no place within identity politics. It's just another tool for power. The final feature number 6, identity politics offers those outside non-favored identity groups a catch-22 solution, a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. So, if you are outside an identity politics group that's favored, that's been granted the authority by society culturally and or politically, those groups oftentimes will say you have two options to outsiders. Option A, submit to our demands and thereby admit that you are in fact an oppressor. So confess, you're guilty. Option B, refuse or even question our demands and thereby prove that you are in fact an oppressor because, you know, only oppressors deny that they are oppressors. This is all redolent of the late medieval practice of witch testing, in which a woman accused of being a witch was cast into the water by a mob. If she sank and died, that proved that she was not a witch, and therefore she was not a threat to the community. but she was also dead. If she fought and floated, did everything possible to survive, that proved what? She is a witch and needs to be put to death. So, the catch-22 options. Now, I want to talk about why this is a problem in a bit more depth. I hope just the description of it is already giving some indication of why this may be problematic and why we need to find a better way to do politics. Before I do, we have to ask and answer the question, well, how is this an ideology? How is identity politics fit within the category of ideology that identified at the beginning? Remember, an ideology is a comprehensive worldview that seeks to describe the totality of reality and prescribe a systematic moral and political response to reality so prescribed in one of two ways. So again, the first way, which qualifies as secular ideologies, is by severing morality and politics from any reference to the transcendent. Identity politics fits very squarely within this first category of an ideology. Why? Again, it's at the epistemic level. By claiming that groups have total authority to generate truth claims by simply doing a circular appeal to their own experience and then to amplify that and apply that outside of the group, what we've just done is granted the group, this could be any group, right? So whatever group you think anyone have in mind, abstract it. I'm not talking about any specific group here. I'm talking about a methodology, a form of thinking that grants the group the power to generate reality. It cuts off the possibility of the system of thought having any grounding in objective reality, objective truth, or being oriented to any objective reality, transcendent truth, or having any kind of objectivity or logos, reason, course through it. So because it hermetically seals itself off from any conception of objective reality, it is an it's sort of secular ideology par excellence. So, why is this a problem? Well, for many reasons, but let me focus on four, and then we'll look at the common good as an alternative. The first problem with identity politics is it embraces, in fact, it celebrates moral relativism. Now, moral relativism can really take two basic kinds of form. One is cultural relativism, the idea that groups of one kind or another generate their own conceptions of what's good and bad and right and wrong, and that it's particular to any specific group. Or subjectivism, which is to say that individuals generate their own individual conceptions of good and bad and right and wrong. Identity politics would fall more into the cultural relativism category, but at the end of the day, that doesn't really matter. They're two different kinds of the same poison. And the idea is that there is no final answer to the question, is this view of reality true or false, good or bad and right and wrong? The answer to that question is there is no true good and bad and right and wrong. Now, that's oftentimes taken as a liberation, right? Human beings have been freed from the constraints of these forms of thought, these heteronomous forms of thought, heteronomous meaning these laws that are imposed from without, from some conception of God or some conception of reality or natural law. We've liberated ourselves from that, and that's a good thing because it allows us to determine what's good. But as Pope Benedict XVI very wisely identified it, relativism is a dictatorship. Why? Because it removes all limiting principles to human action. There's no standard that can possibly be universally appealed to say, you can do this, but you can't do that. So what's the natural outcome of that, or inevitable outcome, I should say, is those who have the most power will get to do what they want, when they want, how they want, and there would be, think about this, no possibility of rational contestation. So you can say, I don't like it. You can say, stop it. But you can't say, that's not fair. That's not right. That's not just. Those words, within the framework of cultural relativism, have zero content. They don't even have formal content. So we have to take them off the table. So this, that leads to the second problem with identity politics. It explicitly authorizes totalitarianism. It has no internal rational limiting principle. There's nothing internal to the system that says up into here and then you stop. Within this realm, you're free. Outside of this realm, you're not free. The limiting principle, the only limiting principle that could possibly exist, is the force of other groups pushing back. So it really does become a war of all against all, unless what? A, you can have a common enemy, or B, you can have a common unfixable fear, meaning a fear defined in a way that can both sort of captivates the population and yet also has no solution to it. So we might think of some potential fears that have been framed in that way for our time. Problem number three, it destroys any conception of inherent and equal individual dignity. People are not individuals. They are representations. Representations of groups. Groups that are not just sociological in nature, but moral in nature. Meaning, some groups are morally superior qua group over other group. Individual worth is determined by group membership. So if you are in a politically favored group, you are worth more than those who are not in politically favored groups. Now, this is so radical, it's not even Hobbesian. So you may know the thought of political theorist Thomas Hobbes, famously saying that the state of nature is a war of all against all. He thought human dignity was also a fanciful idea. But he said, you know what makes, you know what really defines the worth of an individual? The value he or she has to society, meaning are you useful? So you kind of give a utilitarian conception of dignity. So if you're useful to society, you have value. The more useful you are, the more value you have. The less useful you are, the less value you have. This isn't even Hobbesian. This is less than Hobbesian. Because it's not saying whether or not you're useful to society, the only locus of value is in-group membership within a politically favored category. And it's crucial to note here that politically favored categories, given all the premises of this position, they shift over time and without notice. So there's no stability to this system. It really is like, you know, swarming birds that will line up for a period and then disperse and then line up for a period and disperse. So you may be within a politically favored category one day, but there's no guarantee you will be the next day. The fourth problem is it destroys basic conceptions of both commutative justice, that's justice between individuals, and distributive justice, that's justice between society and the individual. So this is a very significant simplification of the question of justice, but I stand by it. I think it's accurate. So the fundamental metrics of justice are what? Behavior and action, and need. Need specifically in relationship to responsibility. So when we look at needs, we also ask the question, is this person acting in such a way that prevents them from being able to fill their own needs? If not, then there's a justice category there in meeting that need. And both behavior, action, and need are in accordance with a fixed, transparent, and equally applied standard. So everybody knows the rules. Everybody knows the criteria, both in terms of the definition of the standards of justice and their applicability. And this is how we create, in a formal basic sense, a just society. However, in identity politics, these categories, these basic fundamental categories which make any conception of justice possible, are discarded completely. Some individuals are punished for their appearance or whatever group they've been assigned to, independently of how they act. Some individuals are rewarded for their appearance or their identity, independently of how they act. Some individuals in need are either assisted or not assisted based upon their appearance or their identity group. So it, in a literal sense, turns justice on its head, any basic conception of justice. It turns it inside out and upside down. So before we look at the common good alternative, it's an important question also to ask, I think, how did this become dominant so quickly? Some of the words that I gave before, these imperious neologisms, you know, even 5 years ago would have been laughably absurd. I mean, maybe you would have heard them in you know, some lecture hall. But apart from that, no serious person would even entertain taking them in any way as an important part of political or moral discourse. And now they have overtaken really every major institution in the West: entertainment, business, government, and everything in between, civic organizations. So how did that happen? Well, one non-cynical response is to say this ideology makes a good show of caring about social justice, or and this would include, you know, justice for the planet. And so it's just, it has a good heart, it's just misguided in its application. That's a non-cynical response. I used to be more sympathetic to that response, but the issue for me is that we've now got to see what this ideology looks like in practice. It's no longer just a sort of free-floating set of ideas. We're now seeing it implemented. For example, in diversity, equity, and inclusion training, we see it implemented in many different kinds of government policies. And we can see, this is totally predictable, by the way, but now we can empirically see that it doesn't work. If the basic premise of identity politics ideology it's to improve justice, and its purpose is to improve justice for those who are suffering most, the most marginalized, then we should at least be able to see some evidence that those who are most marginalized, those who are most vulnerable's lives are improving. The exact opposite has been happening, measurably so, visibly so, in our streets. It's undeniable from an empirical perspective that this doesn't work. So those who are using the excuse, and I'll call it an excuse, they're saying, well, it's just social justice and it may need some tinkering here and there, are willfully closing their eyes. So a cynical response, and I think this is the accurate response, is that identity politics ideology permits easy access to money and power for those who don't have it but want it. It's a con man or con woman's paradise. It legitimizes cheating. And I think this is especially the case with men who are now competing in women's sports. That's cheating. It used to be called cheating, and now it's been renamed as justice. It's been renamed as a positive good. So all that was necessary in order to go from, say, being number 100 in the world to number 1 in the world, or no, that's too much, one being number 10,000 in the world to number 1 in the world in any particular sport is a re-self-identification, and all of a sudden you get to be given money and medals. It also permits those who are already in power to keep, expand, and concentrate it under the guise of virtue, typically called virtue signaling. So if I say the right mixture of words, if I have my employees go through diversity, equity, and inclusion training, or diversity, equity, inclusion training, then I'm covered. I can, for example, pay slave wages to people halfway across the world. I'm one of the good guys because I've said the right words. So in that sense, it's a classic case of diversion. It is also every unscrupulous politician, CEO, or anyone else who has a significant amount of power, dream, because it grants you the power literally to redefine everything. If a man can be a woman, well then censorship can be free speech. Abortion can be healthcare, which is the same as saying death can be life. Inclusion can mean exclusion. Debt can mean prosperity. Centralized control can mean liberty. Oligarchy and aristocracy, well, that's just another form of democracy. Surveillance is for your privacy. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength. So, it has some problems. What's not the solution? What's not the solution is turning to another ideology. Identity politics is a particularly virulent and destructive ideology, but all ideologies by nature will fail precisely because they are ideologies. So utilitarianism is a very attractive alternative. You say, well, we just see what most people want and what's going to make most people happy according to some empirical standard. Psychological expression of, some psychological expression of happiness. And whoever has to pay for that has to pay for that. Well, that's not going to solve the problem of identity politics. It's actually going to lead to the exact same problems. Positivism is just a form of chauvinism. So, we don't accept the premises of identity politics, but we have the laws of our nation. Those are our laws. And so we're going to appeal to our laws. But the question, of course, is, are those laws just? Are those laws good laws as opposed to bad laws? Or is this just another expression of arbitrary cultural chauvinism? So positivism doesn't solve the problems. It leads to the same problems. Pragmatism, saying, well, look, all these ideological debates I find quite tiresome. Let's just get done what we need to get done, people. Right? Let's just find the most useful solution to the pressing problems, and we can have these debates, after work in a pub. Well, that sidesteps the fundamental issue. It's a classic case of begging the question. The question isn't what's most useful. The question is, you most useful for what? For what ultimate good? For what final goal? And so if we can't answer the question of what goal we're actually seeking to increase efficiency towards attaining, then we're just in another case of positivism. Classical liberalism and libertarianism are very siren-songy alternatives, saying, well, look, I am very off-put by identity politics. It frightens me. You know what will work is individual rights defined along the lines of consent. You do you. I'll do me. We will engage in contractual relationships with each other. Otherwise, we'll stay out of each other's way. Now, that sounds, given where we are now, that sounds like paradise. And here I'm collapsing classical liberalism and libertarianism. There's some differences, especially on the conception of distributive justice, but both of them see autonomy as the fundamental and really foundational only principle of justice, understood as being a law unto oneself. The problem with it, however, is that classical liberalism and libertarianism, as I suggested at the beginning of the lecture, claims by its very own internal logic that the question of what's good is entirely preferential. It's entirely self-defined. So you define good one way, I define good the other way, or any other way. And so the government, law, politics, it's just procedural, it's contractual. The issue there, however, is that that just allows absolute relativism outside of specific contractual agreements. So one thing I find very puzzling, for example, it's just one example of many, is that libertarians who advocate for patriotism. Patriotism is a positive good. It's a goal. We should live our life according to the standard of advancing the good of the country properly defined. So I'm patriotic, and I'm also a libertarian. What you're saying, if you say both of these things at the same time, is that I'm a libertarian, I believe in absolute autonomy, and I have a totally preferential expression that the good of the country is something we should pursue. But you know what? There's no such thing as, there's no definition of the good. So the person who's patriotic and the person who is anti-patriotic, who despises the country, within a libertarian framework cannot have a debate. They've already taken the question of the good off the table. So all it becomes then is another power match. It becomes another form. This is where, again, progressivism and libertarianism end up, their enemies up here, but they're ideologically shackled down here. It's just may the strongest man, woman, group win. So that does not solve the problem. Also, crucially, it's based on autonomy, which is a capacity. And if you push the logic hard enough, you would lose your rights when you're asleep. Even when you're dozing, you would temporarily fall out of value until you're awake again. So insofar as individuals, as rights are based on a capacity, we recognize that capacities are sometimes either there or not there. So sometimes you have value, sometimes you don't. And that within the arc of any individual's life, sort of you start off your life with zero value, including when you're like a toddler. So toddlers, the question of abortion and the question of infanticide all of a sudden becomes the exact same thing. Neither one is autonomous. And then you start to get value, and then what happens with the ark? You fall off, eventually having no value again. So it's profoundly anti-human. It's not a solution. And I would also add forms of non-theistic conservatism, non-theistic, I mean, forms of conservatism that may believe in God, maybe even, you know, they're avid churchgoers, but they say the question of God really has nothing to do with politics, and especially politics understood as having some kind of common conception of the good that we all can rationally apprehend and pursue. So what's the solution? The common good. So here's one definition. This comes from the Catechism of the Catholic Church, but it's a basic expression that applies, I think, to all Christian traditions. So the common good is the sum total of social conditions which allow for people, either as groups or individuals, to reach their full fulfillment more fully and more easily. The common good concerns the life of all. It calls for prudence from each, and even more from those who exercise the office of authority, and it consists of three elements. I'm still quoting here. The first element of the common good is the respect for the person. That's the respect for individual dignity. Now notice this is not based on autonomy, this is based upon humanity. That's the first feature. The second is the social well-being and development of the group. And the third is peace, understood as security, the absence of conflict. The basic concept here is that the individual good and the social good within the common good framework are complementary. They're not in conflict. There are no zero-sum games in the common good tradition. There's no one group or one individual benefits at the expense of another. Now, this is all theoretical, right? We'd have to build into the system both finitude and sin. But it's at the definitional level, there's no reason for any kind of conflict between the different among the different components of society. This is not a pragmatic or idealistic conclusion, saying, wouldn't it be great if? It's actually a metaphysical one. It's first and foremost a metaphysical and an anthropological one, meaning the common good is based in a conception of reality, and out of that conception of reality, a conception of what the human being truly is. It goes something like this. There is a natural moral order. It exists. It's real. Human beings are created in the image and likeness of God within that order with a common orientation to an objective and final good. This grounds human dignity. And human dignity has two basic components. One is a fixed component. So to say that human beings have dignity is to say that all of us, by virtue of existing, not by virtue of any capacity that we have, not by virtue of any accidental characteristic that we have, including how we look, including what the nature of our internal desires are, whether they're ordered or disordered, and we all have disordered desires, independent of all that, is by virtue of being human, we have worth. This is the image and likeness of God conception of human dignity. It's grounded in an immaterial but real, individuated but absolutely universal reality, and that's something like we could call the soul. So what does that justify? Absolute equal respect. All human beings are worth the same, no matter what, period. And we have to act that way in all that we do. At the same time, so that stays fixed, adding to that, not replacing it, not diminishing it, adding to it, dignity also has a dynamic component to it. Dignity is something that's also realized or attained. How? Well, by virtue of the fact that we are rational beings and we are free beings, we are free to act in accordance with the good that we identify rationally as good, or we can choose not to. Now, the realization of dignity, then, is based upon the recognition that the good is vulnerable. We can either attain it or not attain it, and we can either attain or not attain it for two basic reasons. One, by our own action and our own responsibility, or two, what? By the actions of others, by the nature of society. So external factors play into this internal decision that we make freely. It can mitigate or expand our freedom to act in accordance with the good. So that means that the realization of dignity is both irreducibly individual, it can't be taken away from any individual, but it's also social at the same time. So this metaphysical and anthropological setup establishes the contours of both morality and politics from a common good perspective. These are the thou shalls and the thou shall nots. So what is always prohibited from a common good perspective? Harming or killing innocent human beings, born or unborn. Discriminating among human beings for any reason other than need, capacity, or merit. Rewarding or punishing individuals for any other reason other than their actions and behaviors. Violating of the individual's free conscience, or treating any individual as a tool or as a means to some putative greater good. So instrumentalizing the human being to use him or her for some other purpose. So that's what, those are the thou shall nots. What are the thou shalls? What's always required from this framework? What's always required is pursuing the objective good of both yourself and others in concentric circles. So you start with the individual and the family, community, region, nation, world. Responding to the objective needs of others to the extent that you are able. Crucially, within this framework, your realization of your dignity, your attainment, your full flourishing as a human individual calls for you to act on behalf of the justice of society, just pursuing the good of others, and rectifying injustices to the extent that that's within your power to do so. Not doing so is to diminish your own dignity. It's to make you less than you otherwise could be. So the social good and the individual good, they're married. They're absolutely married. They're distinguishable, but they're absolutely linked together. What's also required is responding to the objective, not merely perceived, but objective injustice. There's much more to say, but these basic foundations of the common good approach provide a necessary alternative to the pitfalls of identity politics and other ideologies. So first and foremost, and leading to the conclusion here, the common good is not an ideology. The common good is a totality located within a transcendence. It's not a totality without transcendence. It's a totality within transcendence. Where is that transcendence? That transcendence is first at the bottom, below, spatially, we could say. We're not the creators of value. We're not the creators of reality. We're the responders to it. So the good transcends us before. It transcends us at the top. We are not the creators of the final good, nor is it within our power to achieve that good simply by our own powers. Reason can think itself up to its own limits and respect those limits. The transcendence is also within. We recognize that we are finite, and this would be a longer conversation, we recognize that we are sinful as well. So that's the first advantage it has. It's not an ideology. The second is that it more effectively addresses the social justice issues that identity politics putatively cares about while also fixing its four problems. I hope it's become clear, even in this very basic description, that the common good is intensely concerned with social justice properly defined, so much so that it links the individual good to the social good, inextricably so. So what are the four problems that it fixes? Remember, the first problem is that identity politics embraces and celebrates moral relativism. The common good, in contrast, affirms moral objectivity and universality. It says no to bully's epistemology. What's a bully's epistemology? I feel it, therefore you must do it. The common good says absolutely not. Identity politics authorizes totalitarianism. Remember, it has no internal rational limiting principle versus the common good. There's limiting principles at the bottom. We didn't create the value. At the top, we didn't create the final good. And within, we're not God. So what does that mean? No need to rule by violence and fear, which is a necessary component of identity politics. Number three, identity politics destroys any conception of inherent and equal human dignity. Versus the common good, as we just saw, individuals are never mere representation of groups. Each person has irreducible value, no matter what his or her characteristics. But again, that does not come. It's not individual dignity at the expense of the common good. It's not libertarianism or classical liberalism. And four, identity politics destroys the basic conceptions of both commutative justice and distributive justice, again, just between individuals and among between individual society. It upholds, the common good actually upholds the criteria that are necessary for defining any kind of just system. That's acting according to only in response to behavior, action, and need. So we conclude by saying this. What does any of this have to do with evangelization? It's in the title of the lecture. So on the one hand, I hope that the lecture has at least opened the possibility to seeing that identity politics is not only wrongheaded, it's dangerous, and that the common good is not only a superior option, but the best option to respond to it. But this conclusion, I believe, has profound evangelical importance. Why? We live in an age in which politics has usurped the role of religion, both theoretically, so in terms of how people conceive of the world, and also practically, in terms of how people act, including acting in their day-to-day lives. So the political has now become the religious. And so when we seek to evangelize, we have to always deal with reality as it is, in terms of empirical reality, where the culture is in any given time. And so if we're going to address people who have been possessed, I use that word advisably, but I think it's fair, who've been possessed by politics, who have really embraced the death cult of identity politics specifically, well, then we're going to have to talk to them about politics before we can really talk to them about religion. And so the goal here is that if we can, to the extent anyone's willing to listen, to the extent that anyone's willing to engage in a conversation, and I recognize that's oftentimes not the case, and so we have to have strategies for dealing with that, but to the extent it is possible, if we can show through civil conversation, one, that identity politics is wrongheaded and dangerous, and two, that the common good is a better way of doing things, well, then that opens the possibility for what? That maybe not only is there a political alternative that we haven't really sufficiently considered that might be better, so it's politically motivated, it opens the possibility of saying, well, what really holds up this whole tradition? What really makes it possible? What's the condition for the possibility of the common good really being there and really being superior? So we'll open the question of what? Moral objectivity? Human nature having a fixed reality in both men and women, there being a common shared good, and ultimately opening the question of God. So to conclude, I think, and I've practiced this and I spent 10 years before I joined Word on Fire it was a Catholic university, Catholic identifying university, with primarily secular students, and I found this to be effective. Students who wanted, even in theology class, who didn't want to talk about God at all because that issue had been settled. God is, you know, like Sasquatch, you know. We've looked for him. We can't find him. So therefore, he's not there. It's a category error. But they would talk about politics. And so we can use this not only as advocates of the common good tradition, but also as advocates for a reclaiming of the cultural sphere for both the good and for God. Thank you for your time this evening.
Thank you so much, Matt. That was really stimulating. We've got some great questions. We've got very little time left because we let you run. You went over a bit, but I think we were all riveted in what you had to say. So the first question, I'm just going to jump straight in.
Yes, please.
It's from John, and he says, if I understand you correctly, please tell me if this is wrong. One of your key points is that having given up on there being a meaning out there, not constructed by us, to which we should align and attune ourselves, we fall into believing that we are the source of meaning and truth, but in doing so are blind to what is driving our distorting of our reading of reality. And this is inherently divisive and conflictual.
Put it better than I put it, yes.
He's asking you, does he understand that correctly?
Yes, absolutely, yes.
So that's a quick answer. Okay. Would you like to comment on it at all?
I just think it's very well put. And okay. What I especially appreciate about it is that it necessarily leads to that. It's not preferential or dependent on, you know, particular culture. That's where we will end up.
Okay, great. The second question, is those involved in identity politics often have such a strong opposition to others. I assume this is because they view differing views as oppressors, if I've understood you right. My question is, do you think identity politics is making our young people less tolerant? If so, what do you think this lack of tolerance means for us as for Christians and for wider society?
It means very bad things. These are not hypotheticals anymore. We're seeing it happen. We're seeing it happen, especially in our universities. I don't know how much you've been following what's been going on in the United States with the contemporary political and the problem with war. But we also see it in the corporate sphere. We see it everywhere. And again, it's inevitable, because once you embrace the view that my conception of reality is the totality, then any attack on that necessarily becomes an attack on you. So someone's not saying, I disagree with your ideas, here's why, and you say, oh, okay, well, I think that's wrong, and here's why. It becomes, you're attacking me. And so that barrier between the individual and the identity has now been completely removed. So it will necessarily lead to no tolerance, and in fact, ultimately, to violence.
We are so short of time, I'm just going to have one more question. Yes. Thinking about why big corporations have adopted identity politics as a form of virtue signaling, can you say how and why identity politics displaces the issue of economic justice?
Because it's so cheap. It's a cheap fix. I would say, really, you don't have to engage that issue at all, as long as you say the right magic words. And then any dissent, so if someone says, yeah, okay, but you're not paying me a fair wage, you can say, well, I guess you're a racist. I mean, seriously, I mean, that's a little bit of hyperbole, because it says, look, I'm saying these things by definition if you dissent with them, or if you don't agree with them 100% enthusiastically. The only possible motivation you could have is some sort of phobia or hatred or bigotry. And so it completely removes the question of economic justice. Very convenient.
It also seems to me as well, though, it's because it doesn't challenge capital, does it? Because it divides working people. Actually, it sets them against each other.
It does. This
war of all against all.
Yeah, conveniently.
So it's a way for them to promote themselves whilst kind of obfuscating the injustice that's actually going on.
I think that's right.
Okay, we're going to have to wind up.
I'm sorry I went too long.
Sorry, no, it's great. So would you like to take a seat now? Just finish off here. So thank you, everybody. I think we all agree that was an incredibly stimulating lecture, and I think we're all full of other questions. I think you've shown us clearly why identity politics is a problem for economic justice and for relationships, indeed, and why it's based on a flawed view of what it means to be human. You didn't mention natural law, but behind the whole thing, there is this issue of departure from natural law. So I just think that everyone watching will have been touched by this in all kinds of different ways. Some will feel reassured. Others are relieved to know they weren't imagining things. Others will feel challenged. Others might strongly disagree, but perhaps might be provoked to look into these issues more deeply. But I hope everyone listening will feel better informed and prompted to do some more homework and to resist the tribalism that these identitarian worldviews create between right and left, between all kinds of different groups, creating these false dichotomies between human beings. And I think we recognise from this that ideas have consequences. Ideas are not just things that people use in rhetoric and float around. They can actually change things very significantly. So I also hope this will help people understand why our Christian calling is about building relationships and why that's not trivial, and why common good across estranged interests is really important. So thank you, Matt. Thank you for everyone here tonight. Thank you for everyone watching. And finally, just like to say thank you again to CCLA and Word on Fire for partnering with us tonight. So thank you again, everyone, and good night and God bless.